As KUMD prepares to blow out 2017 with our 60th anniversary, we don't want to lose sight of all the things we did this year to get people talking. 30 years of For the Birds, expanded homegrown music festival coverage, the local musician making national news. KUMD was where you turned when you wanted to hear what the loss of David Bowie, Prince, or the other icons who said goodbye this year meant to music. Let's jump right into this conversation with Laura Erickson, who started For the Birds in May of 1986.
Do you ever think about the Laura of 30 years ago? The Laura in 1986 with the albums under one arm and the toddler in hand, coming in and saying, I think I might want to do a radio show, and then look at your life now and wonder, how did I get from here to here?
Well, yeah. Well, we've gone to our high school reunions. Russ and I were in the same high school class. And you could knock people over with a feather when you told them that I did a radio show or that I did public speaking or even that I wrote things for people to read because I was so shy and self-conscious and easily mortified in high school. And then the first years after I started For the Birds, I was so cut to the quick when people sent me nasty letters. One woman was so upset that I had said something mean about the Vice President of the United States, Dan Quayle, in the context of his having this Commission for Competitiveness, which was really trying to gut all the regulatory setup for the EPA. And so it was fodder for someone who cares about the environment of birds, but she was making fun of my voice and making fun of just all these things about me and my ignorance. I guess my spine was stiffening just enough that I sent her a letter apologizing for making any Dan Quayle jokes, because I agreed that his selection as Vice President of the United States was no laughing matter.
When you sit at home quietly by yourself and you reflect on 30 years of the radio program and the changes that that show wrought in your life and in your career and in you as a person, what conclusions do you come up with?
Boy, is life random. Like last night, Russ and I were talking about how the two things I should have majored in college were English literature or field ornithology. I didn't know you could even go to college and study about birds when I started out. It wasn't until I was almost done that I even discovered that there was a class called ornithology, which tells you a lot about my intellectual curiosity at the time. I mean, I was this little blue-collar kid whose parents aspired. I was, like, smart, so I could grow up to be maybe even the head cashier at the National Food Store until I got married and had babies. My parents fought tooth and nail to keep me from going to college. It was only because my high school teachers got me a scholarship that I even got to go to college. As it turns out, those two things that I should have majored in college, I somehow fashioned my life around without the degrees. I've never been very good at following orders. I mean, I've never held a single job in one place with one set of bosses for more than 2.5 years. The time I was at Cornell was the longest job I've ever had. And that one I was totally happy with, but I was homesick. And, you know, there were home issues calling me back. I think I'm just the kind of person who can do something for 30 years if she's not getting paid, has no contract, and doesn't have to do it. That's what makes me want to do it. The one thing I have always loved about being able to do this radio program, which I consider such an honor that you guys have kept me on the air all this time, it's that I've never had to censor myself to toe the line of any underwriter. I could speak out and everybody knows exactly where I'm coming from. Everybody knows that I'm pretty much a wacko liberal, but I don't think anybody thinks I'm speaking out as a wacko liberal only because that's my identity. I think on the radio program, I have always been very clear that any issue I'm speaking out strongly about is simply to advocate for the birds. And I've made that my North Star. That's my line. I think that people realize that when I do speak out strongly about something, it's because that is something that strongly impacts birds.
You've had the opportunity, as I mentioned, in particular this year, to do some amazing travel overseas to look at areas of the world that are hoping to open up to ecotourism, to evaluate them in the sense of birds, and then to come back and do radio programs and write and blog about these places. So to say, are there any unrealized dreams, perhaps, that you have for the radio program? Maybe just in this last year or so, you've realized that all kinds of goofy things are coming down the pike or could come down the pike that you never expected.
What I hoped to accomplish when I started For the Birds, it was a local show. And I never, at the time, there was no such thing as podcasting. And I wasn't interested in getting much bigger of an audience than just KUMD. And suddenly there were other stations in Minnesota and Wisconsin that started airing them. But I liked that it was local. And my dream was that bird watchers and other places would say, hey, that's a good idea. I think I'll start one here. And I'm disappointed that nobody else ever did that. There's a great program that Audubon does out west called Bird Note, which is much shorter. It's produced by a whole bunch of people. It's recorded by a bunch of people. So nobody has the responsibility or the burden or the fun of writing the whole thing and giving it their unique personal spin. And that's one way that I think For the Birds has been unique here. But and Bird Note, they make a concerted effort to make it a national program. So everything they talk about, they want anybody from somebody in Manhattan or in the most rural areas of West Virginia to be able to relate, where I've always been able to talk about home. And when I talk about birds in faraway places, I relate that to home.
Do you ever think about retiring?
Not yet. I mean, heck. When I started For the Birds, just within a few months, they were capturing the very last California condors in the wild. And I wrote a program about the species being doomed. And guess what? I got to go out on my 60th birthday and see California condors flying in the wild. That is thrilling, and it was a wonderful thing that's happened in the past 30 years. That same year, the last dusky seaside sparrows died. That species became extinct right after For the Birds began. And we have for sure, just about, lost the ivory-billed woodpecker. Right now, a lot of our public lands that we so treasure, that hunters have put so much money into setting aside good habitat in our National Wildlife Refuge system, people are starting to talk about privatizing it. That is a scary thing for somebody who cares about nature and wildness and birds. I feel like as long as there's things to talk about, and I still have a voice, which is starting on and off to sound more like an old lady than that 30-something that I started out as. As long as I can speak out, I'll keep doing that.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. KUMD got you talking about For the Birds this spring, but also about the Homegrown Music Festival and the local artist who was in our studios one day and making a splash on the national scene the next. We talked to KUMD's music director, Christine Dean.
I'm really passionate about local music. It's something I've loved for a long time, and we're so lucky to have a great music scene here. And we share local music on all of our programming here on KUMD, all of our local programming. We slip in local music. We have local artists in the studio. So it's something that's really important to us. And we've always had bands in the studio the week of Homegrown. We do extra live from Studio A sessions. But this year, we got a little extra money from the Legacy Fund, the Minnesota Legacy and Heritage Fund, and we said, what are we going to do with this? Why don't we do some extra Homegrown coverage? Because this festival is so important to our area. We're really the only radio station that really has that big of a commitment to local music. You know, we're very fortunate that we're able to do that, that we're local. We're right here in the community. So we're out there, we're going to the shows. You know, I've been to every Homegrown. And so it seemed like this is the right thing for us to do, to step up and take this extra grant money that we got. And we used it to hire a photographer, Max Magruder, who's been doing music photography around the scene for a while. And we said, yeah, we want him. And then we were able to use some of our students as well that are just huge local music fans, and they were thrilled to be out there. And so not only did we have people out taking pictures every night of Homegrown, but we also were able to do blogs. So every day, every morning I'd come in after being out at Homegrown the night before, and some of the students and I would work together, and we would come have these blogs with photos from the night before and a recap. Because the thing about Homegrown is it's all week long, so we know that not everybody can be out there every single night. It's not everybody gets to do that for their job. But people want to know what's going on. They want to hear about the things they might have missed. They want to hear about the cool combinations that happened. They want to hear a review of that new band that they hadn't heard of before. So we thought that was a really fun thing to share with people, and just a really great way to promote the Homegrown Music Festival and be tied in with it, because it's so important in our community. Our music scene is such a vital part of the Twin Ports. So we were just really excited to be able to do more.
You're also a writer, and you're also passionate about writing. So I would imagine that writing about music, having the opportunity to and almost a mandate to write about music, was for you like, oh, goody, let me add it.
Well, the thing about me is I do enjoy writing, but I'm really slow. So doing it on a deadline like that, and, you know, the next morning, oh, my gosh, we have to get this done very soon because it's going to be old news if we don't get it done soon. I haven't done that since my college days here at KUMD when I was an intern. So having that deadline pressure was kind of interesting, but it was fun. Sometimes it's better to have that pressure because then you're forced to crank something out.
I love the added dimension that our website and the internet has added to what we're able to do here at KUMD.
And it gives the opportunity for more people to be able to hear it. You know, we do our live from Studio A sessions usually about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. A lot of people might be at work then, and, you know, maybe they can listen to us, but they have half an ear, you know, or they have to go off to a meeting, they can't listen to it, but they can go back later and listen to it on our website. So that gives more exposure to the artists that we have in the studio, that gives more exposure to the work that we do here at KUMD. You know, it adds another dimension to it, and I think it's pretty cool. Of course, it's another, you know, expense that we didn't have back in the day in radio, but it's a way of getting that information out to more people.
Part of the charm of radio, in some ways, is the ephemeral nature. You know, it's here and then it's gone. And yet I think for more people, hey, I want to see a photograph of what the artist looked like in the studios. You know, I'd like to see a picture of the studios. I'd like to hear the interview again. I'd like to hear the performance again.
Or, you know, sometimes they'll have an interesting looking instrument and I'll comment about that in the interview and I'll say, well, let's put a picture of that in there so people know what I'm talking about. It's always fun.
One of the other things that is got to be marvelous fun for somebody in your position is to watch a local artist take off like a rocket. And Galen Lee from right here in our community, all of a sudden National Public Radio made her their featured guest star on a Tiny Desk concert. Tell us a little bit about it.
Because NPR Music really has kind of a reputation of kind of being tastemakers, it really gives a boost to whoever gets to do those sessions. And it was funny because I had Galen in the studio. She had had a new album out for a while and we hadn't had her in the studio yet. So I finally got around to having her in the studio. And I knew that she had submitted a video for the Tiny Desk concert, but I also knew, you know, a couple other bands had, and you know, they get 6,000 entries, and I, you know, what are the odds that somebody local is going to win? So she and I did the interview, and I had meant to ask her about it, but it just kind of slipped my mind. And then the very next day, she got the news that she had won.
You were last here on February 25th, I think it was, mm-hmm. and I'm pretty sure it's the very day before you found out that you won the Tiny Desk concert.
You're totally right. That is exactly when it was. That's so weird.
So ever yeah. since then, I've been like, oh my gosh. And it's kind of funny because I knew that you had submitted a video, but a few local people had submitted videos, and I had thought about asking you about it, and it kind of slipped my mind, and then I thought, oh, that's no big deal because 6,000 entries. What are the odds that any of Duluth people are going to win? So it's okay that I didn't ask her. And then you won.
I know. That was the biggest surprise of my life so far, I think. It was so unexpected, but it's been a really fun year.
I want to hear about the moment that, how did they notify you and how did you react?
The day that I found out, I was teaching fiddle lessons and I checked my email in between students. I got an email from NPR and it was from a lady named Jessica, and she said, we would like to talk to you sometime, preferably today. And I got kind of shaky because I thought maybe I was a finalist. So we arranged the time to talk. I had to try to focus through a couple more lessons, which was really hard. And then I got a phone call later that afternoon, and it was actually Bob Boylan on the phone. And it was just such a weird phone call. He started out telling me about like all the things he liked about the music, not just that one song, but he had clearly listened to a bunch of other things that I had put out there. And then eventually after wrapping up like what he liked about the music, he said, well, the reason I'm calling is because I want to let you know that we chose you as the winner. And it was just it was so weird.
Wow.
It was a very surreal moment. And I remember trying to just really be in the present at that second because I was like, this moment is definitely a big deal. It was cool.
I don't remember how long it was before she could announce it, but it was so exciting. You know, we've had so many, it's been so fun to see bands from here be so successful. Of course, Lowe has been doing it for years and years and have really built their niche and their following. Trampled by Turtles, watching them come out of here and become so successful. Cloud Cult got their start here. So Charlie Parr has been doing really well. It's just, oh, and the thing is, all these people are just great human beings as well. You know, that's the fun part. Galen won, and she's amazing. She's an amazing person. She had been planning on starting to tour and figuring it out. And, you know, the logistics for her are a little different because she's in a wheelchair. And she was talking about wanting to be an example because she's also been doing advocacy for people with disabilities. That's kind of one of her goals as well as music. And she wanted to show other people that it could be done and how you could do it. And that I love that then she is having this, she won the contest and now she's able to have that big impact, even a bigger impact than she was thinking about in that area. And it's been so fun to see her have some amazing opportunities and get to tour and play with various people. And you know, it was always fun. She's done so many things locally before that. You know, she was with Alan Sparhawk and Murder of Crows. She's been with Dan Dresser. They had a duo, and she's been playing even with even more people. And she, you know, she's just done a ton of stuff. So it's fun to see her even be able to expand on that and to tour. I mean, she went for broke. She sold her house. She and her husband went on the road. So it's just, it's so cool to see somebody so talented, great person, be so successful. It's just heartwarming. And they're from here. You know, it just, you just feel that pride. You just feel that that Duluth pride.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. The entire country was talking all year as one musical icon after another passed away and left us more and more bereft. KUMD and the Northland turned to musicologist and host of Soul Village, Chris Harwood, to help us understand who we lost and why it matters so.
We started off the year by losing David Bowie. His newest CD hadn't even really cooled yet. And David Bowie was gone. What did we lose when we lost him?
For so many, David Bowie, I've heard him described as the musician who proved that being different was okay. Different ways of performing, different ways of being a character on stage, of making music that was a little outside of the box that could still be received very well by the public. Of course, he emerged at the middle and end of the counterculture. So in some ways, that door was already being opened, but he really tore the roof off, as it were. He really showed a completely new way of doing it. The whole glam idea broadened the type of mindset, the type of performance idea that could be out there. A very valuable lesson, I think, for the rest of the music world.
It seems as though that commercial music is even stricter and more inflexible, perhaps, than it's ever been. So was David Bowie the one-off? Was he an exception? Could someone like David Bowie walk into a studio and begin a career like that now, do you think?
Yes. It's sort of one of those timey-wimey Doctor Whovian kind of ideas where because he did that then, he could do that now. If he didn't do it then, it might be harder to do it now. But he wasn't necessarily the exception either. Lou Reed certainly was somebody who walked into a different space and people went with him. The way the Beatles did in the 60s. Think about how much of the music we heard then probably would have had some shifting, but the way that they were always a step or two ahead, leading people in other musical areas away from the 2.5 minute love song, what people then did in the 70s like Bowie and others, that door had, as I say, had already been opened, but it was easier to walk through, and they did it with strong strides, not with tentative steps.
We lost Prince in April.
For Minnesota, we lost an enormous icon. But Prince saved soul music. Now, granted, for some, he did it by using the tools that the 80s are known for, sometimes for better or for worse, a lot of synthesized sound, sort of that 80s pop sound that some people wished hadn't really happened. Prince was somebody who used the studio, much like the Beatles did, used the studio as a tool as much as the composition itself. Used studio tools to create great music. But we lost somebody who was a representative of that era, and has been ever since. We lost somebody who led people in a new direction, much like Bowie did. Somebody who steered so many other musicians into that arena that we didn't realize was there before.
I'd had the opportunity to listen to and read, probably with the advent of his latest album coming out, a number of interviews about Leonard Cohen, and discovered that he had had a manager that had mismanaged or embezzled all his money, and so he had to go back out on tour at an age when he should have been able to kick back and put his feet up and hum little tunes to his grandchildren if he wanted to.
A much more common tale than you'd think. I mean, how many artists throughout the last century were mismanaged, were not given proper remuneration for their art? Other people took the money, and that's a very common tale. That happens to so many, but that Leonard Cohen kept going. Certainly what many of them had to do as well. You've got to get back out there and go on stage, find some way of continuing to generate. Now, he wasn't somebody who did that by just playing the old songs. He kept creating new songs. And many artists have had to do that. Their old catalog disappears. They've got to keep creating and keep inventing new songs because that's what they do. That's what artists do. And there's the old cliche about hanging up your rock and roll shoes at a certain point. An artist continues to create, and when they stop creating, an artist is lost already.
As a boomer, I grew up listening to the music that my mother loved. There were always the show tunes albums. That was kind of a time, I think, there were some marvelous, marvelous musicals being written in the 50s and 60s, and the albums were popular.
It was the second golden age of Broadway.
So when I discovered in a tiny little footnote that Tammy Grimes had died, we had the Broadway album of Tammy Grimes in the Unsinkable Molly Brown, and her voice was absolutely astonishing. And I thought, nobody's doing retrospectives of Tammy Grimes' life. And she was wonderful.
Well, the list of people that we've actually lost over the last year of 2016, it's a sad way to put it, but the second tier of musicians and artists that we've lost that I think give a better picture of just how amazing music is, with all of the people that you don't immediately put at the top, like Bowie and Prince. Sharon Jones, of course, we just lost a few weeks ago. Leon Russell, an artist in his own right, made some great music, but was behind the scenes on so many other people's music. Merle Haggard we lost earlier this year. Such an amazing ear for harmony and an amazing ear for a story. We lost Guy Clark, singer-songwriter from Texas. People like Merle Haggard and Guy Clark laid the groundwork for alt country. We lost Mose Allison, jazz pianist, a person who was able to bridge blues and jazz and humor in ways that nobody else was doing. We lost Glenn Yarborough, who is a folk artist. We lost Dave Swarbrick, who is the fiddler for Fairport Convention. We lost bluegrass legend Ralph Stanley. We lost Maurice White, the founder of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Paul Kantner, one of the founders of Jefferson Airplane. Glenn Frey from the Eagles. We lost Bobby V. Scotty Moore, Elvis's guitarist. Lonnie Mack, the blues guitarist. But we also lost, and I think it's important to mention, two huge titans of the record industry. Their names became synonymous and legendary, not only with the artists they recorded, but because of the quality of the records they made. George Martin, the fifth Beatle. They were just a simple four-piece rock and roll band until he got a hold of them and helped them enrich their music with better arrangements, other instruments, to advise them on ways of making great songs even greater. I mean, he knew them when, but to have the hubris of telling the Beatles how to make their music even better is really something. We lost, the other one, is Rudy Van Gelder. Many people may not know who he is. Rudy Van Gelder was this optometrist who loved music and loved listening to music. He started a studio in his parents' house in Hackensack, New Jersey. Jazz artists from New York would cross the river, go to his house. He had the equipment in the dining room. And it was that dry, sort of reverbless space in this little house in Hackensack where Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Herbie Hancock, Miles Davis, Art Blakey, so many others made these records that are quintessential in jazz history and still are records that people point to today. And to have that Rudy Van Gelder engineer stamp on your record was a guarantee it's going to be of a high quality, even if it didn't sell. All these legendary records that people point to as iconic were created in his parents' living room.
You shared with me, after Sharon Jones died, a Sharon Jones story. You were living in Manhattan.
Oh, yeah. I was in New York, just at a crossroads in my life. I had been at graduate school, studying as one would at graduate school, studying mostly classical music. Somebody played me her first Daptone album, called Dap Dippin' with Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and it was like a punch in the gut. It was being pulled out of the frozen water. It was proof to me, after the Prince era of R&B and after rap and hip-hop had taken this idea of sampling to such a far extended degree that you worried that nobody would know how to make real music in a real room with real instruments, real drummers, real horn players, sitting in a room together making something. It seems a bit snobby to say that, but music has been for thousands of years made by real people in a real room. And I think the 20th century brought us to a place where a studio creation became more important than the real music making that could happen anywhere else. That became the go-to.
I've never met any of these people. I am one of the few Minnesotans that doesn't have a Prince story. We didn't know these people. And yet when we lose them, it's devastating.
Music hits us in so many levels. There's an intellectual component, but there's a deep emotional impact. Musical tones, harmonies. It's like a drug. Music is a drug in many ways. It can change your entire emotional landscape in a moment. Music has a way of hitting the neural pathways in ways that words can't. Music is primal, primitive, and I think we sometimes forget just how deeply it can hit you. But it's not only the quality of the music itself. It's the memories that we tie to where we were when we heard, what we were doing that summer when that song was on the radio, those sorts of things. You think again about how an artist wants to be remembered. And maybe they do want their life story to be a part of the tale that we remember about them. But I think that most artists would say, my music is my document. That's the memorial.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Laura Erickson, Christine Dean, and Chris Harwood. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.